This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Scott Poynton's passion lies in helping create more positive change in the world, and he has spent his life working to bring change in highly complex and challenging situations. A coach, a mentor, a sustainability consultant, a speaker, a writer, and founder of the Forest Trust, Scott now runs his own company called Scott Poynton Limited, and he believes that the key lesson from all of his experiences is that each and every one of us has everything we need to be great change makers. We just need to tap into and develop those inherently human skills. And Scott joins me now to share more about his life's work. Welcome, Scott. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good, Juliet. Thanks very much for inviting me to speak with you.
Yeah, so Scott is joining us all the way from lovely Switzerland. I hear it's a beautiful day over there. Lucky you.
Yes, it's beautiful. Dawned a beautiful morning and went out for a walk amongst the fields and the forest. So very nice here. Yeah, very lucky.
All right. And Scott, I mentioned earlier you founded the Forest Trust, and this was back in 1999. And you were the CEO right up till 2016. But before we talk about that, you know, can you tell me what inspired you to set up the Forest Trust?
Yeah, well, really, it came from a long time ago when I was a young lad, 15 years old. Up until that point in my life, I wanted to be a vet. I loved and I still love animals. And this was my life's mission. And then one day, just after my 15th birthday, I went inside, and on the radio was this very ancient old British forester called Richard St. Barbe Baker. And he spoke on this half an hour radio broadcast about his life's work traveling around the world, trying to inspire people to protect forests, to plant trees. And he was called the man of the trees. And from that moment, I said, well, I'm going to follow in his footsteps. And that's what I did. I was very lucky. I think a lot of young people aren't really sure what they're going to do with their life. But I had that mapped out from 3 days after my 15th birthday. And so I studied forestry. I went to work in Australia in forestry. But my dream was always to work overseas, which I had been doing. And so when the garden furniture crisis, big concern around deforestation in Cambodia in particular, blew up, I'd already been working in Vietnam, and which is where the garden furniture was made. So this led to the founding of the Forest Trust and this really realization of my passion from that day when I was 15 years old.
And, you know, for anyone who's unfamiliar with, you know, the work that the Forest Trust does, I mean, of course, now it's called the Earthworm Foundation, but maybe you could just kind of explain, you know, what the Forest Trust does.
Yeah, so it's really been doing the same thing for many years. And it started with that founding idea that there was a factory in Vietnam that one of the companies that I was working with was buying furniture from, but the wood was coming from Cambodia. So it was quite a complex supply chain, and they wanted to stop buying the furniture. And I said, well, hold on, there's a couple of thousand workers in that factory, and there's some good forest there, good forest management in Vietnam. Why don't we connect your factory to that so that you can be confident that the wood's coming from the right place? So we started in that way of trying to connect the dots of supply chains, because often people, well, certainly the consumers here in Europe didn't know where the wood was coming from. The retailers didn't know. And in fact, as it was, the company that was selling them didn't know either, because it was all bought by the factory. And so the idea of the Forest Trust was to bring transparency so that we could understand where the wood was coming from, and then get out into those forests and work with the people there and say, let's help you manage your forest in a better way. So we did that for a number of years there in Asia, continue to do that work in Asia. Then we moved into Africa, where we started doing similar things with forests there, helping the forests get better managed. And then by 2007, we started to look at other commodities like palm oil and pulp and paper. And gradually the organization just grew and grew. And the work was exactly the same, in the sense that we were just trying to help companies understand where the raw materials came from, how they came to them, and what they could do to be more responsible.
And, you know, I think you wanted to support companies to adopt a values-based approach, right, to everything that they do, and to, I guess, set themselves free to pursue whatever they truly believe in.
That's exactly right. This has been one of the key learnings of my 20 years in this space, is that if companies only look at the bottom line or, you know, key performance indicators or, you know, quarterly results, that that decisions can easily be taken off track. So for example, when you make a commitment to protecting forest, if you're doing it because you think it'll help your bottom line, I can guarantee within about 2 minutes, you're going to have to make a decision that's probably going to cost you more money, because the moment that you say, okay, I'm going to buy this wood, which may be certified or at least it's legal wood, versus the illegal wood, which is much cheaper, it's going to have an instant effect on the price of the product you're offering into the market. And if you're worried about your bottom line, if you're making that decision on the basis of your bottom line because, for example, an NGO, a green group has campaigned against you, you will throw that decision out the window because you're only focused on profit. Whereas if you're acting from a values base, something that you fundamentally believe, and you say, I don't want to be linked to deforestation, and for example, the death of orangutans or tigers, I don't want to be linked to the exploitation of people, communities, whatever, I'm not going to do it. And what that does is it stimulates our inherent innovation to say, right, it does have a cost implication for our business. How do we work in a more clever way to get around it? Because you know what? I'm not going to be linked to those things. And I've seen this time and time again across a whole range of commodities. I mean, TFT Earthworm Foundation now works on about 20 to 25 different commodities. And this is the common theme. When we get people connected to that inherent values that's deep inside them, that are deep inside them, then we see big change is possible. But if we only think about the bottom line, we hit roadblocks very, very quickly.
Okay. And, you know, you were very deeply engaged in the certification movement for many years, but I understand you became concerned and an increasingly vocal critic since disengaging in 2012. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a sad story for me in a way, because when we started TFT back in 1999, this was our mission. Let's get forest certified, because we thought that, for example, the Forest Stewardship Council standard was great, and if we got forest managed according to that standard, it would be a good thing for the world. And I still believe that the standard is very good. But what I'm sad about is the process that sits around implementing that standard. The audits, you know, people talk about independent third-party audit, and that's not independent, because I'm paying you to audit me. And if you don't give me the result that I want, well, I may not pay you, and I certainly will go down the road and get someone who will give me the decision I want. And so it's become a bit of a race to the bottom. And I did a lot of work within FSC, a lot of meetings, a lot of travel, trying to help them. But nothing seemed to change. And this happened also with the RSPO, the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. We were a member for a very short period of time, but all of the failings of certification in the FSC system were very present there as well. And so in the end, we disengaged. I spoke to people. I tried to help people. Finally wrote the book in 2015, published the book in 2015, and was met with a stony silence. And of course, what we're seeing now is more and more companies are talking about going beyond certification. Greenpeace has left the FSC. Having initially criticized, you know, my ideas about certification, they followed suit. And more articles are coming out in the paper now about studies where certification is found to be not only wanting, but certainly failing the environment and people for not just, you know, it's just become a big business. And in Beyond Certification, I even said it was a racket, and I think it has become a racket.
Okay, that must have been a very, very sad thing for you as well, right? To have to come out and say all of that, and also to be met with a stony silence, as you said, after writing your book.
It was, because we invested, I say we at TFT, we invested huge amounts of time. And I personally invested a lot of time traveling, going to meetings. We even made some donations to FSC to try and help them uncover these problems. We shared all of this information with them that we were finding, because we believed in it. I personally believed in it. I thought this is a great standard, as I still do. I think it's a great standard, but it's just so poorly implemented. And there's so many politics, there's so much money involved. And, you know, in many ways, I see them greenwashing illegal practice, not just the FSC, but just greenwashing bad practice. And I'd like to think that I have strong set of values, and we just had to walk away from it in the end. And what was quite disappointing was that when I wrote Beyond Certification, I made it very clear in the introduction that I wanted to open a discussion, because I wanted to try and do something that was going to be better for the forest, better for people, better for the environment. And I said, look, I'm not attacking anyone. Here's my critique of certification. But a stony silence, and even accused of self-interest, because, you know, people were saying, oh, well, you're just writing that to get money to TFT. And so it was really sad. Yeah, it's very sad. I think that, you know, people just either went silent or they attacked me. And I was like, golly, guys, we're really trying to improve the situation here, because I thought we were all committed to the environment. And so many people actually said to me, from the certification world, everything you've said in your book is correct. But, well, why aren't you doing something to change it? So it was frustrating. And I think people get stuck in this, if not certification, then what mindset. And I always said, well, let's focus on the then what. Let's talk about what else we could do to go beyond certification's narrow confines. Let's take the good things from certification, like the standard, but let's develop a system whereby we can remove the things that are corrupting it.
And, you know, just speaking of TFT, you were the CEO right up till 2016. And, you know, speaking of difficult things, that must have been something that was a difficult decision for you as well.
To step aside?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because I'd had this fascinating period really from around 2010 through to the end of 2014. Well, certainly the start of 2014, this really intense four-year period where all of the work that I'd done up until 2010 seemed to come in this culmination where Nestlé was attacked by Greenpeace for using palm oil that had been purchased from Golden Agri Resources in Indonesia. The famous one-minute Kit Kat orangutan finger video, very powerful. Yeah, blood everywhere, and this was a huge campaign that raged across the world. And Nestlé didn't handle it very well. I knew a few people at Nestlé, and I said, look, I'd love to talk to folk there and see if we can help. And that's what happened. And this led to me helping mediate between Greenpeace and Nestlé, and as a result of that, produce the world's first ever no deforestation commitment. And this was fantastic. And then that led to the same negotiation process with Golden Agri Resources. That led to Asia Pulp and Paper, the sister company of Golden Agri Resources, coming on board with their own no deforestation commitment. And then at the end of 2013 with Wilmar, the world's largest palm oil company, committing to no deforestation in a very broad policy that went way beyond just their own plantations and brought in all the exploitation and other factors like this. And I drafted all those policies. I helped mediate them and negotiate. And it was a magnificent time, but deeply intense. And what happened was during 2014, there was an explosion of commitments. Once Wilmar went, everyone went. And so there's this tsunami, I would say, of commitments from people signing on board to no deforestation. And I think not everyone's implemented them, but certainly these leading companies have invested a lot in implementing them. And I think what happened, Juliet, was during 2014 and 15, a lot of TFT's work came to that operational work to help our members, Wilmar, Nestlé, Golden Agri, APP, all these other companies, to implement their commitment. So it became very operational. And my work was always the work in the dark room with the CEOs, with the chairs of the companies, working out what to do. And in some cases, taking a couple of years to navigate that journey. Very intense work, a lot of travel, a lot of stress, but I loved it. And when we moved into that more operational phase, I must say, it's the wrong word, but I sort of got a bit bored with it and started to imagine what I could do on a broader horizon. All of these lessons that I'd learned sitting in those dark rooms about how change happens. You know, when you go into that room and you know, you've got a hand in your face and everyone's saying no, and you come out, you know, maybe 2 years later or 6 months later, in the case of Nestlé, it was about 2 weeks later, with this groundbreaking policy. What happened in those rooms? And what were the outside influences to bring change? And I thought to myself, well, we've got this fantastic team at TFT. Let them deal with the operational side of things, and I'll try and share the lessons from this incredible and, you know, I'm a very privileged experience to be able to sit in those rooms with these quite amazing people who are running these big businesses and with the NGOs who were trying to bring them to change. I met so many fantastic people through that process. How can I share those lessons? And that was really a key part of the reason for leaving TFT. I was also burnt out. I'd been traveling like crazy in very stressful situations. I had two heart operations in 2016 to recover. All good now, but I think I just needed a break. Yeah,
I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm glad that you're doing better.
I think I just, you know, I was taking over 100 long haul flights a year, and in 2012, you know, I was some months I was three times a month in Indonesia working with the companies there, you know, negotiating, pushing forward, mediating. And when you're the mediator in the room, it's pretty hard work. It's pretty stressful, but so enjoyable when at the end you come out with this incredible commitment and you see the companies implementing it, you know, investing millions and millions of dollars to invest these commitments. So very rewarding. But the other aspect of it is that I've seen so many nonprofits in particular, but I think businesses as well, where you have this founder and CEO stay with the company and stay with the company and stay with the organization. And then finally they leave and everything falls down because they were the organization. And my view is that I will measure the success of my work as a founder by whether TFT, or as it's called now, Earthworm Foundation, is still running and flourishing 10 years after I've stepped aside. And because I think it's no good if we set up these terrific organizations doing these great things, if the moment the founder steps aside, or, you know, in worst case scenarios, passes away, and this happens a lot. You see these 70 and 80 year old founders, and they eventually just fall off their perch. And the whole organization collapses around them, and the great work that they're doing collapses around them. And I didn't want that. And I wanted TFT to be able to flourish without me. So a lot of people said, oh, it's your baby. How could you walk away from it? Well, as I'm finding now in my personal life, my two boys are 22 and 19. They are growing up and they're going out independently into the world. And I viewed TFT in much the same way. And I'm excited to say that it's still going forward and it's still doing great work. So I'm so far, touch wood, 5 years into that journey of me having stepped aside as CEO, the organization's still going well. So I'm feeling that, you know, I might be able to give myself a tick box as a not a bad founder in a few years' time. Fingers crossed.
I'm speaking today to Scott Poynton. He is a coach, a mentor. He's the founder of the Forest Trust and the principal of Scott Poynton Limited. And we're discussing his work, you know, through the Forest Trust. But after this quick break, we're going to talk about the work that he's currently doing through Scott Poynton Limited. You are listening to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today from Switzerland is Scott Poynton. He is a coach, he's a mentor, a sustainability consultant, speaker, writer. He's also the founder of the Forest Trust, and Scott now runs his own company called Scott Poynton Limited, and we're discussing the work that you do. Scott, so, you know, before this, we were talking about all the different things that you did through TFT, and I just wanted to quickly ask you, I know that, you know, after you stepped aside as the CEO, you were urged by some colleagues to write a book about the work that you'd done. And you did publish what is called The Magical Appearance of Earthworms, under a pen name, though, I believe. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, no, that's an interesting story, Juliet. And I did, as I stepped aside, really at the end of 2015, my very good friend Julian and another great colleague at TFT said, right, now's the chance to write a book about all of the things that you've done. You know, how did you get these commitments from these companies? Tell us the story of TFT. And I thought, well, that would be a good thing to do. And then I sat down to think about it. And what emerged from that was this strong sense, the real lesson that I've learned. As you mentioned when we started the talking at the start of the discussion, that I found that change happens really deep inside people. You know, I say deep inside the recesses of the human heart. And What I found is when I can help people get connected to fundamentally who they are, then these grand and bold and unprecedented decisions can take place. And part of that journey was, you know, when I'm sitting in the room and with the chairs and the CEOs and the senior executive teams of these companies, and when I'm, you know, in another room with, you know, senior campaigners and very serious NGOs from some of the big global NGOs, and people are yelling and they're upset and they're angry and they're, you know, they're really, sometimes they're yelling at me because, for example, Greenpeace is not in the room, or, you know, the people from Mighty Earth are not in the room. They can't yell at them even if they were in the room. So they yell at me, you know, so I become the proxy. So how could I sit in those rooms and be yelled at and just manage to sail my boat through those processes and stay focused on the outcome? And I realized that it was partly this story of, well, who am I as a person? And so I've long had the stories that are now written in The Magical Appearance of Earthworms as my deep friends. These are stories from my childhood. And I realized that I could sit in the room with those upset people because of the experiences that I had. I believe this, are the experiences that I had when I was a child. And so if I can help people reflect on their own journey, their own experiences, and look back on the experiences that they had as children, perhaps it can help them find that connection to themselves, which can then help them, I would say, lead a more full life. So when I sat down and I got my computer out and lifted up the screen, and the first thing I wrote was chapter one of a story of when I was 4 years old. And I sent it to my good friend Julian. He was in New York at the time, and I was in the mountains in Italy. It was winter, it was Christmas. And I said, what do you think of this? And he was expecting a story from 1998, just before I started TFT, about the garden furniture campaign. And here's this story of a small boy in a car driving with his father, who was smoking like a chimney, on a road to another town. And the emotions that I was feeling, and it just went from there. And so I wrote this story all the way up until that moment, 3 days after my 15th birthday, when I listened to Richardson Barr Baker on the radio and decided to become a forester. And I told a lot of the key stories of my life in that intervening period. And I had to, in the end, change to use a pen name, because there are some challenging stories in there, and some stories that one of the characters in the book in particular could probably take legal action if they felt that I was saying something wrong. So I was required to use a pen name by the publishers. But, yeah, it's just a story of my life, and I think I've had a lot of great feedback about it, and I just want to – I wrote it because I want to help people connect to their own story, and I think that's part of that journey of being a great change maker.
And that is something that you're doing now. I mean, in your own words, your life's work has now pivoted. You know, though still working on forests, your focus is on people. And, you know, also you've said before that you've always been interested in change. So, I mean, tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, you know, I've always wanted to bring change and try and help those processes. You know, right from the start of my career, I was working on things, you know, before TFT, to bring change, projects to bring change. You could look at something and say, well, that's not working really well, is it? What can we do to fix that? And during that process, I always found that you generally can't fix things on your own. You need to work with other people. And sometimes these people have diametrically opposed opinions to you. They think we should go towards A and you think we should go towards Z. Well, how do we find a way forward in those situations? And I just found I had some sort of knack about doing that. And this was revealed, I think, further in my work with TFT, where I was able to mediate these pretty stressful situations. And so what I learned really in that process was this whole idea of getting people connected to themselves. And one day on a walk up the mountain here in Switzerland, it just occurred to me that if we can take – we desperately need change to happen at scale in the world. You know, we're looking at climate change. There's so many things. You know, there's plastic pollution. There's the Black Lives Matter and racism things. There's so many problems in the world. And we can't solve them alone. So we've got to get people to talk to each other. And I mean talk and then listen to each other. And we can't do that if we're yelling at each other. We form into little tribes and we shoot rockets at each other across wastelands. So how do we get people to come into that middle ground? And I think that's been my life's work. And so what I'm looking to do now is to really, and I've done this work, you know, just look back on those experiences and what are the key elements of how change happened in those really intense situations. What was the ecosystem of change? I was sometimes just the little sprinkling of pixie dust on the top, where a lot of the tension was created by the NGO campaigns, the market campaigns, and also created tension inside the people who are inside the companies who are being attacked. They didn't want to be shamed and blamed. They weren't, you know. I remember Nestle, the famous quote from Nestle was, "We don't want to kill orangutans. That's not who we are." And so I said, so who are you? So who are you? What do you want to do? If you don't want to kill orangutans, what do you want to do? Well, we want to protect forests. Okay, so let's do that. What's stopping us? Oh, we'd never sort of looked at it like that, you know? And so turning it around, and I like to think I'm always pretty an optimistic person. I like to see, okay, we're in this sticky situation. How do we move forward? And so what I'm looking to do now is, you know, through my work, you know, with my changemakers community, is really to try and share those lessons so that not just young people but anyone in the world trying to bring change can share those. I can share those experiences and that knowledge I gained from being in those dark rooms with a whole range of absolutely fascinating people and seeing how change happens, this ecosystem, where the pressures come from, and where a kind word sometimes can just help someone cross a bridge.
And that's so fascinating, you know, what you said. You know, we go in looking for a fight, right? And without actually understanding what it is that everybody wants. So, I mean, the NGOs didn't want orangutans to die, neither did Nestle, but, you know, they weren't communicating that with each other. And it just needed you to ask that simple question. And that is so important. Communication is so important.
It is, and it's the way we communicate. And I write a lot with blogs and things around the way we communicate. It's so important. And you've hit the nail on the head with Nestle and with Wilmar and all these other companies that I worked with. They didn't wake up in the morning saying, you know, rubbing their hands together, how many orangutans can we kill today? You know?
Oh, God.
You know, they don't. They're good people, and they don't say, you know, how many lives can we exploit today? How many people can we you know, put in forced labor so that we make lots of money? That's not who these people are. And yet this in many ways is what they're accused of. And so when they're first accused of it, their first reaction is one of anger, and it's one of I would say it's violent, and because the attack is often violent. And so you know, people bunker down, they start, you know, shooting words at each other via press releases, and it's like, people, we need to come into this room and have a chat, because you both have common ground here. None of you want to be destroying forests. None of you want to be exploiting people. Now, some of those things are happening as a consequence of the way the industry runs, the way you're running your business. But I know you're not doing that with intent. I believe, and this is, again, I think one of my really core beliefs, is that we all have good inside us. And the fact that you may be a CEO of a company that's deforesting doesn't mean you're an evil person. It means that you're following an industry model that generates income for your shareholders, all of those things. Now, if we can sit down and talk to people about that, and the fact that, you know, there's people are being exploited, villages are being thrown out, most people, if you talk about it and say, look, we can do this in a different way, let's talk about that. My experience is that not 100%, but more than 90% of the people will say, okay, we don't want to do that. Yeah, okay, so let's talk about a way forward. So if you come to people with compassion, and I think the key thing here, and I'm a broken record about this, is don't bring judgment. Don't bring judgment. Don't assume that someone's evil or bad. And this comes back to even to our day-to-day lives. When you go into the office and you talk to someone and how are you going, and they maybe snap at you with some comment, the first reaction is, oh, you know, what's wrong with Mary today, or what's wrong with Bill? And well, maybe Mary or Bill have got a headache, maybe they're sick, maybe there's pressures on them at home that we don't know about. So if we can look at those people with a bit of compassion, we don't rise to anger, and suddenly there's not a fight going on. We actually bring compassion and say, how are you going? Is everything okay? Or we just give them space sometimes and let them get through it themselves. But too often I think we rise to anger, we rise to judgment, we make assumptions of where people are at, and we don't take the time to actually talk to them and learn about that and say, how do we move forward? How do we get out of this place? And I've seen so many people and companies paint themselves into tiny little corners, and they're just bunkered down in there. They put their feet in concrete. They steel reinforce the concrete. They're not moving anywhere. And yet sometimes just a metaphorical arm around the shoulder, and just to sit with them and listen for a while, helps them to move out of that place. And I think that's the path to making the world a better place and to helping people do good things.
And, you know, I understand there's a big emphasis, you know, talking about Scott Poynton's change makers, there's a big emphasis on connection, right? Connection to yourself, connection to others, and also connection to nature. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, I'm very blessed all my life, really, to have lived a long time in nature, or, you know, in little towns connected to nature. So here in my little village of Zhanjiang, I can just walk up the hill and there's forest, there's fields everywhere. I'm in nature the whole time. And what I found is that what's interesting is there's a whole raft of, you know, new research about this coming out now. Of course, there's this Shirin Yoku, I think is the pronunciation in Japan, forest bathing, you know, and so going into the forest just calms us down. It gives us space, it de-stresses us. And so doctors now, in Scotland and other parts of the world, are actually prescribing to patients perhaps with depression or with health issues to go and spend some time in nature, particularly in forests. And I found this all my life by walking in forest. And so I actually take people now on walks into forests, and with my colleague Julian Trussier, we do retreats where we take people into mountains, we take them into forests and just time in nature. And what we find is that those stresses, those pressures that they're feeling, that inability to imagine a future doing something different from where they are today, they just can't see those things. But when those stresses start to fall away because they're smelling the earth in the forest, they're feeling the wind on their face, they hear the birds singing, I find it very opening. And then you can start having conversations with folk in a completely different way. So part of the work that I do is helping people get connected to nature. And if you're sitting in the, you know, in the 35th floor of a large building in Jakarta or in Singapore or in Europe or in America, sometimes that connection to nature has been lost. And it's difficult to take such executives out into the bush, as we say, because, you know, they just don't have the time or you know, they just can't imagine it. But somehow you can bring nature into the room, you know, just through pictures, through discussions, and I find it very opening. And once you've got them into that open place, and I'm talking about being open inside, they really connect to themselves and they can start hearing that voice inside them saying, you don't want to be connected to that bad stuff. What can we do to move forward here? And so nature is a key tool, I think, in helping people find that connection to themselves and then a connection to others. So I think it's a really important part of our toolbox in helping bring change.
And tell me more about, you know, the whole thing, you know, I mean, are you looking for people to join, you know, does that involve participation from others? And if so, how do people join?
Yeah, so I've got a Scott Point. It's www.scottpointon.community, and people are able to join. It's a free community. And so they join in there. Well, they have to answer five questions, but they're really just, you know, tell us about your experience. You know, what do you hope to get from change makers? So I haven't rejected anyone yet. You know, it's really just, you know, whoever wants to come can come, and I welcome people to join. And so I've only started it really about a month ago. It's funny. I've been looking for years to find an appropriate platform, and one of my friends actually from Malaysia who used to work for TFT, Yu Ping, she wrote to me about 6 weeks ago and said, I've learned about this platform called Mighty Networks and it just might be what you're looking for. She knew I was exploring this possibility, and have a look at it. And so I did, and it seems to have great functionality where you can, it's a bit like LinkedIn, it's a bit like Facebook, you can talk to each other, you can have messages. So what I'm hoping is that it becomes a really vibrant community. I've sort of soft launched it a couple of weeks ago. We're already up to about 90 members, and I'm posting ideas there. I've got a couple of little free online courses. There will be bigger courses that where people will be able to, they will have to pay to get access to those courses just so we keep the thing ticking over. But there'll be coaching groups, mentoring opportunities, and people can ask questions. They can say, look, this is my situation. Anyone on the community can give advice. People can share poems. They can share experiences. It really is like a Facebook group. And so it's not really a closed community, but rather than just making it anyone can join, I did want, you know, I want people to go through some sort of process and step to do that, just so that, you know, they're committed to it. So far, as I say, it's been going for about 2 or 3 weeks, 90 people in there. I think a lot of people are on holiday. There's not a lot of interaction, but I think people are just looking to see what comes. But as I post every day or every second day, just some thoughts, some reflections, and now I'm starting to develop some courses for young entrepreneurs, for other people, it's starting to pick up. And I'm excited about it because I want it to be a vibrant discussion. And I loved the idea that, you know, imagine someone in Ipoh or somewhere there in Malaysia or in Singapore or in Indonesia or somewhere in a community in Brazil could write in and say, we've got this situation and we'd like to see what we can do to bring change. Can anyone here on the community give us some suggestions? And then people could jump in and say, well, I had that experience here and this is what we did. And so really to make it a really important and valuable resource that the community can help each other and we can help take change to scale by sharing our knowledge, experience and lessons. That's the idea of Scott Point's Change Makers.
Okay, all right. So, you know, if anyone's keen, they just need to head to the website, answer those quick questions and then take it from there.
That's right. scottpointon.community. It's really it's easy to get in there. Yep.
Okay, all right. And one other thing that I wanted to talk to you about was a new initiative as well, which is called My Carbon Zero. And I think that helps you take your own climate action. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges we're facing now, right? And tell me a little bit about that. You know, what is it designed to do and who is it designed to help?
Well, that's right. It's a new initiative and it's gone live, and we're aiming to help. Initially, I started thinking about helping businesses take more responsibility for their carbon emissions. And, you know, everyone seems to be at this place now of talking about carbon neutral and offsetting. And it's a little bit like certification for me. I, You know, it's a tool. It's one thing you can do. And what a wonderful thing if the whole world would be carbon neutral. But you know, it's not enough. It's we need to go beyond carbon neutrality, because what carbon neutrality is let's say I'm a business, I emit 1 million tons of carbon every year, and somehow through funding projects somewhere else in the world, I prevent 1 million tons of carbon to be emitted. Now, the reality is these certification schemes in carbon have all the failings of the certification schemes that we talked about earlier. And so they're not perfect. And what we want to do is say to people, look, here's four actions that we want you to take. This is businesses initially. We want you to reduce your carbon footprint. So instead of emitting 1 million tons, we want you to look at your practices and drop that down to 500,000 or better, 200,000. And I think in the last 5 or so years, companies have started doing that more, because initially companies were just saying, well, I've got 1 million tons, I need to offset 1 million tons. And they weren't actually trying to reduce it. That's changed. More companies are trying to do that. So that's the first step. Reduce your own emissions. The second step is you'll always get to a point where there's a residual, where you can't reduce it completely to zero, because just by eating and breathing and living, we've got a carbon footprint. So that's when this so-called offsetting can come in. Invest in projects that will reduce emissions elsewhere. So that's cool. But the reality is, and you know, the IPCC's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UN's modeling says, you know, if the world over we stopped carbon emissions today, if all the carbon emissions went to zero today, we're still in deep trouble. And that's because of all the carbon that's already in the atmosphere. So when companies talk about carbon neutrality, all they're doing is trying to reduce their emissions. And really, emissions, carbon emissions are like a pollution problem. It's like we're throwing rubbish on the street outside of our house. So let's say every year I throw 10 bags of rubbish outside on the street in my house, and the neighbors are throwing their 10 bags, and that person over there is throwing 20 bags because they've got a different lifestyle. If I'm saying I'm going to reduce my emissions, well, that means I'm only going to throw 8 bags of rubbish onto the street. So look, that's better than 10, but it's still not great, right? And the reality is, ever since I was born, I've been throwing rubbish onto the street. So I've got this big pile sitting out the front of my house, and that is all smelling and a bit putrid now, and everyone else has got their rubbish out there on the street. And that's the carbon, that's the metaphor for the carbon that's in the air already that's causing the climate change we're facing now. So we've got to get carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's not just good enough to reduce our emissions. So what I'm proposing with my Carbon Zero, and I started this with some blogs and ideas back in 2016 when I was still with TFT, is companies need to go beyond carbon neutrality. So let's reduce our own emissions, let's reduce emissions elsewhere, let's get carbon out of the atmosphere, so that since our inception, we end up saying, I haven't put any carbon into the atmosphere whatsoever. And then let's inspire other people to do it. So they're the four key actions that sort of underpin my Carbon Zero. And then I thought to myself, coming into 2018, well, that's all very nice of me to be calling on companies to do that. Why don't I do it myself? Because since I was born, I've been putting carbon up into the atmosphere. And so I looked at that, and I worked out a very easy way of calculating my carbon footprint. I think it's about 750 tons since I was born. And so what I'm doing is reducing that. I'm funding projects elsewhere, and I'm investing in projects, for example, one in Cambodia, to put carbon back in soils. So I'm taking carbon out of the atmosphere. This project is taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it back into the soils for smallholder farmers in the form of biochar. So the farmers benefit, the environment benefits, and I'm locking carbon away into the soil for at least 100 years. So step by step, I'm investing in projects like that, in tree planting projects. And I thought, let's make that opportunity available to other people, because it's no good if it's just me. And so that's what my Carbon Zero is about. It's to help businesses on the one hand, but also to help and inspire individuals like you, like me, to say, I'll take responsibility for my carbon footprint. Because you know what? For the last 20 years, we've been asking governments to do that, and that hasn't gone too well. So we really need to take responsibility ourselves and not ask someone else to do it. So my Carbon Zero is a community that's linked in with Scott Poynton's Changemakers. There's a My Carbon Zero community for businesses and a My Carbon Zero community for individuals there that people can join. There is a fee for joining, because we help people to set up their own carbon, what I call a carbon balance sheet. So we work out for you how much carbon you've emitted, and then we work out what projects you might do to get that down to zero. And we help them do that. So there's a very small fee for that, an annual fee. Likewise for businesses, small businesses and larger businesses. We help them take responsibility for their carbon emissions, and then we guide them on what they should do for their investments. And that's where they do have to invest some reasonably significant funds, because getting carbon out of the atmosphere costs money. So that money doesn't come to us, it goes to the projects. So it's all on the website. It's mycarbonzero.community. And I'd love to welcome people, to help individuals and businesses to that, so that we can help people take their own climate action and not wait for someone else to do this for us.
Yeah, I think for many, you know, the problem seems rather insurmountable, you know, and they're looking for guidance and they don't know where to go, or, you know, they just need some sort of structure, I suppose, you know, on what to do and what not to do. So this is a great way. And it's I think adding the word community to it really helps as well, you know, to make you feel that you're not alone. You know, there's a lot of people who are interested in doing this.
That's right. And I think, you know, also, as you say, Juliet, there's a lot of people who want to do something, but they don't know what to do and they're a bit stuck. And there's people saying, well, I'd like to do tree planting. And then they look and there's about 400 opportunities to plant trees through various organizations. But which organization do you choose? Then there's exposés where people, you know, organizations have taken money and not used it correctly. So as a consequence, people who want to do something get very nervous. They don't want to put their money in a situation that it's going to be wasted. Or, you know, you've got a wonderful NGO somewhere who's planting thousands of trees, but 99% of them die the next year because there's no follow-up. And so I'm sort of using all of the experience that I've gained at the TFT looking at these projects and helping those NGOs and young entrepreneurs to build robust projects so that they can genuinely attract investment from concerned citizens, from concerned businesses, and it becomes a win-win because the individuals and the businesses can put their money into projects that they know is going to have a real impact. And then, of course, the people out on the ground doing those projects benefit. So, you know, for example, the project there in Cambodia, it's helping these smallholder farmers, and the farmers are seeing in some cases yield increases of 100% in their crops. And this is a beautiful thing because it helps them make more money. They're using less fertilizer, less pesticides, less water. So they're adapting to the challenges of climate change where the rainfall is less. They're putting carbon into the soil and they're not filling up the rivers with runoff from fertilizer and all these things. There's so many co-benefits from these projects. So I want to be able to say, look, based on my experience, I know that's a great project. So if you want to take carbon out of the atmosphere, invest in this one. I've done the checking for you, and I've been in this for 20 years, almost 40 years of working in my life. I've seen a lot of bad projects, a lot of misleading projects, but I've seen a lot of great projects too. So let's help the average person or a small, medium, large size company differentiate those perhaps not so great projects from the really impactful projects, and let's get money to those great projects so that we can do more good in the world and people can start taking their own action on climate and just helping the planet overall. I sort of call them, you know, earth-serving actions. We're serving the earth, and that, of course, helps us.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Scott. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but, you know, if anyone would like to get in touch or to find out more information, I believe the website that they should hit to is scottpoynton.com. Am I correct?
That's right. That's my personal website. And from there, they'll see links into the various My Carbon Zero and the Changemakers community. Yep, it's all there.
All right. So if you'd like to find out more, again, the website to head to is scottpoynton, that's P-O-Y-N-T-O-N.com. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.